Welcome, welcome, welcome. This is the Detraction Pieces Podcast, episode 394. And I'm joined today by a returning, just one of my favourite people in the world. It's Mr. Nick Frost. I love this man dearly. And we've been having a lot of talks back and forth over the pandemic. And we thought, right, now's a good time to jump on Zoom and do a little podcast for you guys to hear. If this is your first time listening, go back and listen to my first conversation with Nick. I first had Nick on in 2015. If you want to have a look at other people in the back catalogue, I've had Simon Pegg on twice. He was on around 2015 as well, maybe even end of 2014. But then he was also on recently for the Where's Your Head At episodes, which in fact I should mention because a lot of the people that we talk about in this podcast are on there. For the month of May, I did a series of mental health specials and spoke to Florence Pugh, to Lena Headey, to Simon Pegg, to Stephen Graham, to just loads of really amazing people. I'm trying to think of other really good highlights for me. Connie Huck, Fern Cotton. Yeah, just loads of really good people. I also had my 10-year-old goddaughter on. I had my mum on. I had my dad on. I had loads of interesting people. So, yeah. Go and check them out if you haven't already. But again, as I said, if this is your first time, have a scroll through the back catalogue because I've had a lot of good people on. My tip is always if you head to Scroobius Pipio on Instagram, in the kind of highlight stories, I've got each year of the podcast there as a highlight. So it's kind of easy to scroll through. It's only of the last 3 or 4 years. So you'd miss a lot of the early superstars like Stuart Lee and Alan Moore. And just loads of people who don't do a lot of podcasts. Paddy Considine. I'm trying to think of more people that Nick's worked with that I've had on. I've had Adam Buxton and Joe Cornish. Yeah, loads of good episodes. Go and give them a listen. But this is a chat with Nick Frost. And we get straight off the bat, we get quite heavy and honest and open. There's loads of other good lightness and amazing insights of some of his recent experiences on set, on and off set. So yeah, if you enjoy the podcast and want to support it, you can head to patreon.com/ScroobiusPip. That's like $1 a month. But if you want some merch, then head to speechdevelopmentrecords.com. There's DVDs, there's vinyl, there's CDs, there's t-shirts, sunglasses, vests, jumpers, hoodies, everything you could imagine, umbrellas. So yeah, head to speechdevelopmentrecords.com for all that goodness. Let's get into the podcast, guys. This is the Detraction Pieces Podcast, episode 394, with the legend, Mr. Nick Frost. This piece of fiction is the intro to Destruction Pieces. This piece of fiction is the intro to Destruction Pieces. This piece of fiction is the intro to Destruction Pieces. This piece of fiction is the intro to Destruction Pieces. Right, I'm here today with Nick Frost. How are you, man?
Hello, mate. I'm all right. How are you?
I'm good. I'm good. I'm happy to see your a lovely face. We've not had a face-to-face or Zoom catch-up in a minute. So, yeah, it's a treat.
No, we haven't. I'm a little bit agitated because I'm meant to be going to have like an MRI on Friday.
Right. What's that for? Anything good?
No. There was nothing good comes from an MRI, but it's not bad. It's one of those things that because I'm like almost 50, yeah. My girlfriend was like, you have to go now and have a massive health check.
Yeah, it makes sense.
Which I did, it came back all great. But because I'm on Bupa, they were like, you're paying for it, so you might as well go and have an MRI on your prostate. So I was like, yeah, fuck it, all right.
Yeah.
But now I've just spoken to them to say, do I need to fast? And they said, no, but you need to have an injection. So I'm like, nah, I'm done. I'd rather just die of a horrible prostate disease than have an injection.
that's a reasoned and thought out decision. I'll accept it.
Just can't. I won't do it.
But, I mean, stuff like that interests me because I feel, if I may be so bold, in the last year or so, I feel you've been on a bit of a journey and it feels like you know yourself better than you've ever known and you know where you're where you are in the world and things like going, right, let's get a health check. It feels like, is that part of a more mind and body thing in total?
Yeah, I mean, as you know, I mean, I've been working on my mind a bit and happiness. Being happy, you know, that seems a really simple end place to be, but it fucking isn't. It's really difficult, you know. It's weird just to imagine that humans as a middle place would just be happy, and then you can either be unhappy from there or even happier. You know, it's where I have been for a long time. Happiness is the middle place. You know, it's not the place where I dwell. So yeah, part of that is also, you know, physically taking responsibility for where I am. You know, it's fine to be 30 years old and weigh 22 stone and you're rolling around and you're doing all your own stunts. And, you know, I did a lot of that on everything I've done all my own stunts and stuff.
Yeah.
But then, you know, when you're 50 weighing the same, it's like the fact of the matter is big, fat, funny men of 50 do not become big, fat, fucking funny men of 60. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I think it's my responsibility as a dad, if I want to give my kids, you know, it's fine making them laugh and having a fucking giggle with them and taking them to the pictures. But if my son has to wear a little fucking black suit when he's 12 and bury me, it's like, well, what good is all that fathering, you know?
Part
of being responsible and trying to be happy in myself is also physically trying to not fucking be dead in the next 5 years. That seems really bleak, but it's
it's a true and real focus.
You've got to wake up, you know.
Yeah. And it's interesting because I feel the entertainment industry in general gives little time for focusing on yourself or on happiness. The focus always quickly becomes how successful you are, what the next job is, how that job did, who's doing better than you, who's getting the roles that you're going up for. And it can become overwhelming. I think it's the same in music. It's the same in acting. I've seen it in every entertainment industry. It's as soon as you're part of that machine, it's completely natural to get caught up in, I'm successful, but who's more successful than me? You're never looking at who's less successful than you. Yeah. You're always looking at who's more successful and who's at the next level. And that can mean that you sideline the focus on your actual self and your actual your happiness and your life. Again, there'll be so much that we do in acting, for example, that you go, it's part of the job. It's part of the job. I've not seen my family in 6 months. It's part of the job. I've not had a day off in X amount of time, or I've been working 12-hour days every day.
That's filming.
It's part of the job. It's like, that's not acceptable, is it? It's a mad one. We need to take the time to... And people in every industry, I think it's weird comparisons, but I think it's the same in retail. Like when I worked in retail, I would do so much unpaid overtime because it's like, but we've got the inspectors coming soon and we want to be like high on the HMV store rankings and doing these different things that are a detriment to yourself and your own mental health and life because, well, it's work, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, it's also that thing where, especially when you've written it or you're producing it too, or you're starring in it, where, you know, I've literally had producers say to me, but you want it to be good, right? And it's like, yeah, of course I fucking do. I've spent 2 years writing the thing, but at what cost, you know?
Yeah.
And I think there's also a thing, like in fucking retail, or I was a waiter for years. It's like, you know, the fact of the matter is, if you don't work, I don't get paid. I don't get any money. You know what I mean? It's like, that is also mentally, that's a fucking huge weight to bear, you know, as a man, as a father to, you know, two kids. I've got another kid on the way in fucking 6 weeks.
Amazing.
And it's like, well, it's easy to forget that in terms of I've got to work to provide for all that.
Yeah.
You know, again, I ask, you know, at what cost when the kids don't fucking see you or they see you stressed or fucking frightened or I'm always, I think, aware that when kids see their parents as being human and fallible, you know, that's always, I think for me as a child, when I saw that in my parents, that was always like, that's always stayed with me. So I'm aware of my kids seeing that in me and how they see that, you know.
Yeah. It's a weird one because it's important to see that. But as a kid, man, can it be scary and disorientating because it's your parents, it's your mum and dad. And then you see them, like still, I'm working on a story about it at the moment because still, honestly, I think the moment that has stuck with me most in my life is, and I've spoken to both my parents about it, is when my parents sat me down to say that they were splitting up.
All right.
And I'd never seen them vulnerable and that kind of person. And it was, again, it turns out it's been part of forming me into the person I'm proud to be today, because it's realizing that we're all human and that it's not as simple as man should meet woman, have babies, get married and be together forever. There's millions of ways for relationships to work. There's millions of ways for different interactions to work. But still, that's it sticks with me as a moment, because it was like, oh, they're just people. I didn't realize they were just people. I thought they were mum and dad, but they're just people.
Bulletproof.
Yeah.
Yeah, I never thought, part of me wanting to try to fix my mental health came when I was just sat crying next to my fucking then 6-year-old son, who put his hand on my hand and he said, "Are you all right, Dad?" And it's like, fucking hell, what? I'm responsible for that, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
That was me that did that thing, you know? It's really fucking, it's weird having kids. It's weird having kids and also trying to keep the facade of everything's fine.
Yeah.
You know, I think sometimes I like the fact that they're getting older now and you can say, hey, this is the deal. This is how this is going.
Yeah.
And it's fine. You know, my oldest son, his grandfather passed away a few weeks ago and stuff. And he really, you know, he was asking lots of questions and we decided he wasn't going to go to the funeral in the end. And at some point I said to him, hey, it's all right if you don't fucking feel anything, you know.
Yeah.
You don't need to feel fucking sad. It's absolutely fine. Because I think there's that weird, I don't know, it's just, as a parent, I think you're responsible for validating every emotion, not just fucking happiness or crying.
Yeah. We're experiencing that in justifying our choices as actors as well. Because every choice is right. Every choice is right, really, because this is how I would have reacted. You can't tell me I wouldn't have reacted like this. This is how I would have reacted. But a while ago, a few years back, I was talking to Stephen Graham, and he said a real breakthrough moment for him was when he was filming Pirates of the Caribbean, one of them, and Johnny Depp got injured and he was going to be out there for a longer time. And he was really in a bad way because he was like, look, I want to see my family and all that. And the production said, you know, you're big enough for us to fly your family over and you can have them here and they can be part of this. And he'd never considered that because he comes from a working class background. He never considered he can make demands. And I know
don't
that
want to put anyone out.
Yeah. And I know that you've just had what sounded like, from the conversations we had, a great experience of making Why Women Kill in LA, because you took your family with you and it wasn't this, I'm going to go away and work for however long, see you later, I've now got to do this on my own, I'm going to have these nights where I get back to a hotel room and I'm on my own with my thoughts and I've dealt with a big scene that day. You didn't have that. You said, well, let's all, particularly as we're in a pandemic, you know, schools and all that kind of thing are up in the air anyway, you kind of went, let's all go to America. So how was that? And did that feel like a big thing?
Yeah, man, absolutely. It was, but it turned out perfect in the end, because it's like, because I'm not with my son's mother.
Yeah.
So I've got two baby mamas, two different kids, but we all co-parent, you know, as a unit. But I never wanted to leave my eldest son, because I've got a baby and a 10-year-old. It's like, I never wanted him to look at where I was with a baby and my partner and say, why am I not part of that? You know, I was always really aware that that was a possibility and I didn't want to make him feel like he was somehow being punished or he wasn't fucking part of the gang. But he's old enough now that we all sat down, all the mums and me and the kids, you know, the kids that were a separate conversation, but everyone was like, let's just fucking do it. It's an amazing role. We're lucky to be working because the pandemic's on. We had a nice house all booked up and, you know, we did that thing that my current partner and our baby were going to be there full time. And then my son and his mother came for a month at Christmas and a month at Easter.
Oh, beautiful.
So it was fucking perfect. It was amazing. You know, even though everything was shut down and stuff, we could still go on the beach every day, which was bloody great when we weren't filming. It's a funny thing too, when it's like 72 degrees in LA, like we're on the beach and just shorts and the kids are in the water and stuff. But people have like parkas on and that, and track jumper. And they were looking at us like we were bonkers. We were like, this is fucking summer, guys.
Yeah, this is the best it gets.
Yeah. But yeah, I mean, look, I mean, I couldn't, I just couldn't, I didn't want to be alone on my own for 6 months in Los Angeles. You know, I think it was, I didn't want to be alone. You know what I mean? I did that for so many years. I isolated myself for so long. Now it's like, nah, it seems that isolation seems like it's a warning sign for me, you know. Yeah. It's like, I don't smoke anymore, I don't drink. It's like, oh, let's eat this fucking kilogram bag of M&Ms, you know. It's
particularly in America, man.
Eating like that will fucking kill you as quick as drugs and drink.
Yeah. It's, and again, I genuinely think those things are harder in America and Canada and places like that, because all the Ben and Jerry's are different flavours.
Oh,
my
God.
All the chocolates. Like, I had a point where I was shooting in Canada and I had a topless scene coming up. I'd only found out, like, a week before. So I was trying to eat healthy all that week or week and a half, and I was working out a bit more. I tried
getting
to keep
your pump on.
Yeah, I was getting my pump on. But when that week ended, my fridge was so rammed, because despite the fact I'm not eating them, I can't see new sweets I've never seen before and not buy them. So I was just stockpiling. Whereas previously it'd be, oh, I'll have a little chocolate bar. It's like, no, I'll buy it in case I never see it again, and I'll put it in the fridge until we've wrapped. So that last 4 or 5 days after I wrapped, I practically put myself in a sugar coma. But I was like, I've got to clear the fridge. I can't. I'm coming home now. I've got to get through this.
Let's just get rid of it.
Yeah. So how was Why Women Kill to work on? Because it's a big production, and crucially, you're an actor rather than a writer, producer, and actor. So, because obviously, prior to that, you did Truth Seekers, which we'll get onto. But basically, I'm asking, did you need to do something where you can more turn up to work and do your job and go home?
Yeah, I mean, it was just, it was so nice. You know, it was, before we got there, you know, a couple of weeks before we started, I met Alison Tolman, who I essentially did 95% of my scenes with.
Yeah.
And she got it, and we've become really close, you know, since making the show, and we speak to each other all the time, and she was over with my family all the time. And,
great.
You know, the producers couldn't have done enough to accommodate me and my family. The scripts were bloody great. But then they said, you know, if you have a voice, so if you want to change something, let's pitch it. You know, it was very collaborative in terms of during rehearsal. If you wanted to pitch something, you could pitch it. And if it was funny and everyone liked it, then it went in, you know. But I mean, I like that. I love working, you know.
Yeah.
I love listening to what the crew say and they're in jokes and what the camera team are up to and what size fucking lens we're on. And
how did you find that in these times? Because I'm a big fan of that as well. Previously, I love to hang around on set once I've wrapped if I can and things like that. But in this time, that's not possible and it's not safe. So there are there's bubbled groups. So the camera crew are all together and so on and so forth. So how was that to kind of have that slight limitation?
Yeah, well, it was difficult because like, every job I go to, they end up making me an Apple box. Like the carpenters make me a box to sit on because I like to sit right there in amongst the scene as it's being built, which I guess is fucking annoying. But during COVID, I couldn't because it meant that all the crew had to keep their double masks on, which was annoying for them. So I'd kind of step off and find some quiet place in the back of the set, you know, so I could just sit and be on my own and think about the lines and think about what I was going to do. But then there was an odd thing that everywhere I went, I had like 3 or 4 COVID reliance officers would stand around me, like so to make sure no one would come within 2 meters of me.
Wow!
And then wherever I walked, I'd have like a phalanx of COVID officers in front of me, like literally shouting "Red Zone, coming through!" Because if you're an actor, you were called Red Zone. But I was saying to them, it's like it really creates an us and them.
Yeah,
vibe when everyone has to fucking scatter when I walk on set. It's like everything I hate about Hollywood, so to speak.
Yeah,
but I think as it went on, it just became slightly looser, you know. And I'd say to the guy, I'd rather stay here if we're just going to quickly move a light. And it kind of loosened up a little bit as COVID started to ease off, which was amazing. But you know, I'd say to the COVID guys. Also, what I found weird is there was a few scenes that were fucking hard to film emotionally, and like those things that you take home or it stays with you for a bit. But like once they said cut and then we were going to go straight away again, someone from COVID you'd feel a hand come in and they'd literally just put a mask over you, and I'd have to say, just please, just give me one,
chill,
give me a second. Do you know what I mean? A couple of times I had to go and find them afterwards and say, I get what you were doing and I'm really sorry, you know, but I just needed to not have a piece of plastic between me and the woman I'm killing.
Yeah, it's such a learning curve in these times. Anyway, honestly, the bit I found hardest was And my driver to and from set, his van he was picking me up in didn't have an automatic door. And because of COVID, I'm not allowed to open the door. He has to get out, come round, and open the door for me. And I felt like the biggest prick every time that happened at the start of a day.
People watching you.
At the end of the, as if I can't open a door for myself. As if I'm like, can you open my door, please?
He's changed.
Yeah, exactly. I just felt awful every time. Like, we'd have our visors on and whatever and a screen in between, but we'd be chatting all the way, interacting and getting on. Then right at the last minute, it felt like it switched to master and servant. It was like, if you could get that, thank you. fucking horrible.
I had a few. Well, we had twice. Once was my fault, and the other time, but I had a massage like a week into shooting. I'd kind of not tweak myself, but I was knackered, and my partner wasn't there yet. So I was like, I'm going to have a massage. And I found this masseur, and she came to the house and gave me a bloody lovely rub down, and I felt great. And she got all the knots out and stuff. And like 2 days later, I got a text message from her, and it said, I've just had a test and I'm positive. You should check yourself. You should test yourself. And like the first thing that flashed into my mind was like chlamydia. Like telling my wife that I'd slept with an escort and I've now got chlamydia. I was like fucking, I had that vibe in my stomach. But I had to tell production, and that was it, man. I was shut down for 2 weeks.
Oh, wow.
And, you know, again, coming from that Stephen Graham school of acting, it was like, I'm responsible for this. And I now fucking will feel terribly guilty for days and send endless texts to producers saying, guys, I'm so fucking sorry, you know.
Yeah.
But again, it's, you know, like flying your family out. It's like, what can you do? It's just, someone had a badge on set and I'd seen it before, but it was like, it says, relax, it's only television. And I'm like, the older I get, the more I'm like, yeah. It's just fucking television.
Well, I mean, did you need a reminding of that after working on Truth Seekers? Because I love Truth Seekers. I spoke to you guys when you were working on it in the pre-production stage, you, Nat and James. But I know that that was a stressful one overall because, again, it's you being a key person on camera but also writing, producing, wearing so many hats all at once. How was that as an experience? Yeah. How did you get through it all?
Yeah, it was fucking, you know, once Ryan was fun to start with. We laughed a lot. We fucked around and we wrote some good stuff. It just never felt like we got it. You know, we never sat down and had a conversation, which essentially went, what about the end? How does the end go? How do we get there? You know,
yeah.
I mean, in hindsight, we would have worked that out and then got to that point. But we just started off writing, and because it was like Monsters of the Week and then a kind of connecting tissue somewhere within that, it just got really fucking difficult. You know, after about 5 months, it was like September and we started shooting in November, and we just literally sat in the office for a week, not talking, not writing, can't make any movement forward. We don't know what the fuck we're doing. You know, James quit. Then he came back on Monday. Nat quit at 1.2. I fucking pretended to be ill and stayed at home in bed for a week.
Yeah.
It just became fucking horrible, you know. And then we got to a point where I spoke to someone about it, and there was a strand in the show that had been in there from the beginning, and we never thought we'd ever lose it. But then we just said, why don't we just take it out? Let's just remove the whole thing. And it was like, we were like, what? I mean, is that? And we did it. It took us about a week to get all the bits out and put it together, but it just fucking freed it, you know, it freed it. And it started to move again, and we knew where we were going. But it was fucking, it was really difficult. So when we got to shooting, there was a real relief in terms of, oh my God, we did it. We really did it, you know.
We got here. It's such a weird industry for that because, again, I think it's comparable to the music industry as well, that there has to always be a level of believing you've got more in you and you can do it again. But The reason I mention that is from the outside, it might sound crazy to people that you were like, we started writing and we didn't really know where we were going. But I finished every album and thought, what if that's all my ideas?
Yeah.
And then you start the next one and go, it's worked previously. It'll work this time. So it makes sense to me to hear that the three of you went, right, we'll sit down and work it out. And then when you hit a wall along the way that it's like, we're not working it out. oh shit.
Yeah.
It's terrifying.
Because it was fine writing weird, like, individual stories, because we all had, like, two episodes each, but then it was like there was no through thread or bigger picture. And, you know, at 1.2, we had to kind of, the budgets were slashed, so all the big fucking set pieces had to come out and villains had to be lost, and there were no sets, there was no locations we could use. You know, it was just a real fucking drag, you know.
Yeah.
I don't know why it has to be so difficult. Really?
It's mad, isn't it?
Even the commissioning process is, you know, there must be 60, I mean, how many, like Disney, and how many apps are there, and how many SVODs and platforms and Netflix and Amazon and BBC and Dave and Five, and, you know, it's like, you think it would be easy to fucking get stuff commissioned, but even when you've been doing it 20 years and you're kind of known and people like what you do, you think you could just walk in with any old shit and get it commissioned. But it's like people, it's really, really difficult, you know.
Truly. I remember the last time I met up with you guys, I popped into the office and had a catch up with you and Nat and James. And at that point, I had a script. I was running around and just hitting wall after wall. Couldn't get anywhere with Netflix. We'd spoken to Channel 4 and a few others. And as we finished that meeting, I said, what are you up to today? And you were like, oh, I've got to go and chat with people at Netflix about an idea. And I looked at you with just, with hate in my eyes. Just, can I come? Can I jump on the end of it? Can I just pop up the end and go, oh, by the way, I've got an idea as well. But yeah, it's a mad industry for that, isn't it? The fact that all of these companies, quite rightfully in a way, have to be really regimented and rigid on what they look at and what they see, partly for legal reasons, partly just for scheduling. But
yeah,
it's a mad world of it all.
Yeah. I mean, I think in terms of Netflix, you need to either have, you know, if you're a documentary about Pablo Escobar or Nazis, then you're fucking quids in.
Yeah, you're sorted. So how have you found it on the production side of things? Because another thing that Stolen Picture did was Out of Her Mind, which I got to be part of. And you and Simon made me the cool kid at school on the table read, because no one knew that you two were going to be there. So we're all there for the table read. I'm only in one episode. I'm excited to be involved. I'm sitting there ready to do my couple of scenes. And you two walked in, and my instant reaction was, hey, and came up and said hello and excited. And then I realised the rest of the room's reaction was, oh, my God, Nick and Simon are here. Oh, my God, this is exciting. And so I looked like the cool kid because I was like, hey, how's it going, guys? And then everyone's looking over thinking, so what's his role? He must have a big role. And then it gets around to, I'm like, I've got two scenes. I mean, they were good scenes, but
they were good, yeah.
Yeah. But how is that, having that kind of side of things?
It's odd when you start. I mean, for me anyway, personally, it was to get into that side of the business. It's like, honest to God, I didn't know how a film company made money before I became a producer. It's like, you know, I was a waiter, then I acted for 15, 16 years. And in between that time, I wrote a book and I wrote some films and stuff. But I didn't know the nuts and fucking bolts of it. You know, I think I could have probably directed if you got a good DOP and a good first. But the world of production, of being a producer, seemed like, I don't know. I mean, I'd worked with Naira Park and she was like the best. She is the best. So to then I'm there with Miles, and he taught, you know, Miles was our CEO who fucking sadly died last year.
Yeah.
But he taught me everything, you know.
Yeah.
He's a very, very clever man, and he was like an amazing lunatic. So I'd literally just watch him and listen to him and just learn, not how to do it, but learn the processes and what was needed. And, you know, he was very gentle, but he could also be insightful. It's a tough side to the business, you know what I mean? Because it's nice being an actor, because you can just sit in your trailer and you learn your lines, you come out and you do it and you go home and, you know, you eat that chocolate you hadn't seen before and that's that, you know. But when you're on that side, it's like, every fuck, you get phone calls at 11 o'clock at night, you know, 4 a.m. People are, you know, it's odd, but I like knowing about it now. You know, I think it's fucking interesting, and I think it's another, what's the word, another notch in my bow. It's like,
yeah,
you know, I think it taught me that, well, there's more than one way to skin a cat, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
You can put deals together and you can get things off the ground, and you know, if that's your thing, you know.
Yeah, it's an interesting area of the business to learn, I bet, and it probably affects how you see other areas of the business as well, because you're then, when you go back to just being an actor, you're probably appreciating it more and appreciating the time in your trailer more and understanding the struggles that other people are going through. Again, yeah. if all you've done is the acting side, and you would have seen it with loads of actors, I have, there can become an entitlement, there can become an illusion that they're the most important person, regardless of how early the makeup department got to set and how late they're going to be leaving set, and all the crew. I've seen it with actors who start to get that illusion that this show would be nothing without them, when in reality they're just part of the team.
Yeah.
So I think being on the production side must just highlight that even more, right?
Yeah. I mean, I think part of my problems were about getting involved too much, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And so it was nice now. It is nice to be able to sit back and say, that's not my problem. I know that seems very selfish, but the other way was really damaging to me in terms of getting involved and saying, oh, I'll do it. You know,
yeah.
I know when I did Badlands, I ended up just rewriting tons of stuff like every day. And any scene I was in with Daniel, I'd be like rewriting it and sending it in and say, what do you think about this? Or rewrite the end of an episode, or which I fucking love doing. But also, it's like, it's not your job. Just yeah. relax. You know, obviously, you want to make it as good as you can. But, you know, it's not my responsibility. And I always, my whole career, have always taken on that it was my responsibility, you know. When in fact, it's like, just shut the fuck up, you know. Do what you're getting paid for.
Yeah, yeah, completely. So how was it? Another one I wanted to talk to you about, because I've not watched it yet, but I was excited seeing it happen, is The Nevers.
Right.
Because that sounded absolutely bonkers. I was almost in that. I had two auditions, and the role I was up for was the one that Martin Ford got. How can me and Martin Ford be up for the same thing? He's like, I worked with him on another thing, and he's literally a monster.
He's massive. He's amazing.
He's amazing. He's absolute beast. So yeah, completely the right choice. But how was that to work on? Because it's big and monstery. But it's medieval and periody and
hell of a mix. It was, you know, as I said, I've been around doing this for 20 years now. But there's still, you know, I have that kind of condition where I fucking don't belong here. You know, I'm imposter syndrome, and also I fucking get anxious working when I do, like, you know, before any job, I will be fucking physically ill and I'll cry. And my wife will sit me down, my partner will sit me down and say, you'll be fine, you're going to be fucking fine, you know, it'll be all right. Yeah. You get like this before every job, and it's like, you know, it literally fucking crushes me. And so then to get on set, and there's 1,000 extras, and here's Joss Whedon, and there are 50 buses from 1860 and 200 horses, and it's like, there are a lot of people there to potentially watch you fuck up, is what I always think.
Yeah.
You know, and I think, once you get over that, and I think that's part of the skill of being a screen actor, is that you can essentially, for me, once I get into the scene, it's about me and the other person, and, you know, the focus puller comes and measures up. And then there's a bit of light in you, little chat, hey, boom, boom. But it's just about me and them.
Yeah.
And I can literally forget about the rest.
Yeah, you've got to make it as small as possible.
Yeah.
Right.
Otherwise, if I start thinking about the fact that there are 500 people on monitors watching me act, it's like, nah, I'm not, you know, I'm going to fuck up. But also, you know, sometimes you'll see in your shot, you're doing a really great scene about, you know, someone having a baby, and you'll see an electrician just behind the camera do it on their phone, or, you know, I think it's a real skill to be able to do things like that, and then just have someone walk in and just tinker with something, or just nudge a light slightly, and you've got to keep going, and
You gotta keep doing it.
I'm kind of proud of that skill, you know. I really liked it, but I was in like for 6 days essentially, and then COVID struck. So we had like 9 months off.
Right.
They just shut us down for 9 months, 10 months. So it was fucking, it was weird, you know, it was weird. And then you don't see any other, anyone else's stuff and stuff and that. So it was nice to get back after I did the thing I did in the States. And then they were saying, oh, we're going to go again in September. So we start shooting again.
Yeah.
I start shooting again in August, September. But they said, oh, we're going to get you on a big Zoom with all the writers and, you know, Philippa, the new showrunner and stuff like that. I was like, oh, fuck, right. Okay. So maybe I should know what happened in the show, you know. And like, I happened to look on Twitter and saw someone dressed as like in a fucking spacesuit with a gun. I was like, what the fuck is this? I was like, well, the show I started was set in like 19th century London. So where did this fucking go? And so I had to go and, because I didn't watch, because we hadn't got HBO. So I had to like, I was reading it, reading about what happened on Twitter. I was like, oh, fuck, this is great.
This is how it
goes.
Then
you're like, oh, that's why you shot that little bit. Like, I get it now. So now I kind of went into that meeting talking about like the space section of it, thinking like I knew like Johnny Rigbollet.
Blagging it. I love that. It's interesting what you were saying earlier about kind of mentally trying to scale everything down and be small in the moment. And there's a memory I've got that I always draw from in those moments on set where you are, you kind of, there's all this stuff around you, but you have to remember it's between you and that person. But I remember I went to see Fugazi at somewhere like the Hammersmith Apollo, and they were being supported by Billy Childish. And Billy Childish is like an icon of playing pubs and all sorts of things like that. And there's this huge stage, and they set up as if they were in a corner of a pub.
So they
literally took up the middle, like, eighth of the stage, if that. They set the drums there, they put the amps around it, and it was one of the best gigs I've seen because it had that energy. You kind of instantly, the rest of that massive void, if they'd tried to fill that big space, it would have felt empty. But because they went, no, that isn't there. In our minds, that isn't there. It just drew you in. And that's something I draw from a lot in those moments where you're on a huge set and you're like, oh, fuck, there's a just lot going on
small,
here.
So,
no, there's not. There's not. All that's happening is in this space.
Also, I think as an older actor now and a bit more experienced, I found it's all right to say a couple of times doing Why Women Kill, you know, it was, for me, it was really dialogue heavy.
Yeah.
And, you know, a thing I kind of tell myself a lot is I'm not a fucking computer. I'm not a robot, you know.
Yeah.
If you come to me 2 days before a scene with a six-page scene and say we're doing this on Monday and it's now Saturday evening, I am going to fucking have trouble learning that.
Yeah.
I know some people, Alison, who I work with, who I work on the show, she looked at her scenes that fucking morning in the costume chair. You know, I know Amanda Abington does that too, and Simon's a bit like that.
Yeah.
And I think, wow, what a fucking skill. What a skill to be able just to kind of get the sense of it there and then in the morning, then hone it down as the more and more rehearsals and takes you do. That's incredible. But I just can't do it. I have such a fear of fucking up and letting people down by fucking up that I overcompensate by I'm up at 4 a.m. doing 2 hours of line learning. Then when I finish work, I do fucking 2 hours at night, and that's every night for like 7 months. And it's, you know, I'm lucky enough that I've got a partner that is like, oh, I understand this is your process and you have to do what you want to do, but if I fucking need you, then you got to come, you know.
Yeah.
But it's all right. I'm saying it's all right a couple of times during takes to say, I just need a minute, you know. I think there's that weird thing when you're acting and you're behind and you've got 11 pages to shoot and you can't go over and people are like, come on, let's go. It's like, just relax, you know. It's that's not how acting is, you know. Sometimes it is like that, but other times it's fine to say, I fucking need a minute. Just give me a minute. Because, you know full well, if the DOP or you know, director of photography said, I need 10 minutes to relight this, then he's given 10 minutes, you know.
Yeah.
Which is fine, which is beautiful, because they do an amazing job. But I think sometimes that's also allowed for me.
Yeah. I worked with a great director and producer on Debris, this guy, Patrick. And we were talking offset and he was saying, one of his things on every set is if there's ever any rush or anything else like that, or we're short of time or anything else, he's like, the only person that you can tell is me, because I don't want my actors being told we're running out of time.
Yes,
we need to do this, or we need to do that, because he's like, I'll deal with it. I'm the one that should make that work. And it was perfect. It meant every day on set with him was the most relaxed. And this was network TV, and you know how that is on the kind of the tight turnarounds and all this, all this kind of thing. But every time he was directing or producing, it just felt so relaxed and cool. And then you'd finish and you'd realize how tight it actually was, how close you were to not getting it. But you didn't get any of that until it was over. And that's a real skill.
That's also, I think, one of the joys of what we do. Sometimes that fucking lunacy is so fucking great to be in the middle of, because it's like 10 to 8 and you've got two shots to get and everyone's just pushing in the same direction and you go 1 minute over, but you get your shot.
Yeah.
And it's like, and that's a wrap, guys. Thanks for a great day. It's like, yeah, we fucking did it. That's, you know, that's a...
Yeah, man, there's an energy
there. That's few and far between, those little, you know, that's what I do for free, that fucking feeling, you know.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there's a few more things I want to talk about. We're running out of time more and more. I want to talk a little bit about fighting with my family, because we've not really talked about that, and I adored it. I'm a big wrestling fan anyway.
That's all good, yeah.
And when I heard you were cast as Ricky Knight, I was like, this is fucking perfect. And then, yeah, I just thought it worked really well, and I loved watching more and more people kind of dismiss it as they went into it and then come out the other end going, oh, that was fucking great. Like going in going, I'm not really a wrestling fan. I'm not really a this or that. And then coming out the other end going, that's just an amazing story. So how was that to play somewhat? Because the Knight family, for those who don't know, are kind of a legendary British wrestling family, and their youngest daughter went off to join the WWE and have huge fame and success as Paige. But they're real characters, man. They're big characters. How was that to play Ricky and to get it right?
I think as an actor, you can say something like, well, I didn't want to do an impression of Ricky. If you, you know, you didn't want to. But I just, you know, I think once you have kids, it makes it easier to understand another father's drive.
Yeah.
In terms of what he'd do for his kids, you know. And so in doing that, it becomes easy then, because, you know, he's a fucking family. He's about his family, you know, and there's nothing that's going to get in the way of that. And he will protect that. And, you know, he's a great dad, despite the fact some people would be like, oh, I don't want to be on holiday near those guys, you know.
Yeah.
But they're a lovely family. And he's a great dad and she's an amazing mum. And I was really nervous, I was really nervous going to do press in the States with Paige, you know.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh man, I hope she's fucking nice, because this could be really tricky doing a tour.
Yeah,
if she's a diva and she's horrible, but she was so fucking lovely.
She's absolutely golden, isn't she? Yeah,
and her boyfriend. It was so nice, you know. And we just got so much support from the wrestling family. And I think once there was a day we had, me and Jack and Lena and Florence, where we essentially spent the whole day in the ring, and all the extras were people from the British wrestling community. And a lot of people in the audience were like wrestlers or family of wrestlers. And we spent the whole day in the ring, and I probably took like 50 hits that day.
Yeah.
And it was one of those days where you finish, and everyone did. Like Lena did, and Jack, and like people come and pat you on the back, like extras, and they say, well done, son. Well done, mate. And it's like, I think after that, people were like, oh, well, they're not taking the piss, and they're committed to it, and they're respectful of it. And I felt it changed then, and they were like, right, let's fucking get behind this, you know.
Yeah, I love it. Is there any, when you play the father of actors, is there any extra pride when those actors in real life, because Florence and Jack are both smashing it and putting in some real award-winning, award-nominated performances, is there any weird extra pride having at some point put yourself in the position of being their parent, of seeing them doing well and going, oh, look at them, aren't they doing good?
None whatsoever. I've got kids to feed.
I love it.
Also, it's weird. It's like, it's very fair. Like, I look back and I think, how did I become the dad? I don't get it. But of course I get it. I've got kids. But it's like, when did that happen? That I can be cast as a 50-year-old? You know, it just creeps up on you.
It sneaks up.
Yeah, I mean, listen, just to go back, obviously, I like people to do well, and I'm happy that they're smashing it. But, you know, it's like people... There's a weird thing in TV and film now when you do press and stuff. Like, one of the questions on Why Women Kill Press was like, hey, if you could be any character from season one, who would you be? And I had to say, I didn't fucking watch it. And I'm not... There's a weird thing. It's like people expect... You're expected to know everything about the yeah. universe and be a massive fan of the thing. And it's like... The truth be told, it's like these are. I love doing it, but these are jobs to me, you know.
Yeah, yeah, and your focus is on your character, yeah. not on the entire back catalogue, and particularly on a yeah. thing like that where they're kind of separate.
Yeah, stories. Yeah, it's a really odd question. It would be like, oh, I don't know.
I don't know.
But also, I have a weird thing about hypothetical questions. It's like, what? So what? So, what's the point? Yeah. Get, it's a weird thing. Like sometimes in press, people say, so who do you think would want to fight between Thor and Batman? It's like, I don't fucking care.
Whoever the author wants to win the fight.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, exactly.
It's as simple as that. Before I wrap things up and ask what's next, another thing I loved and I want to ask about, how did you find playing yourself in Staged, in the episode of Staged that you and Simon did? Because it's a weird thing to play. It's a different thing to play yourself or to play a yeah. version of yourself or a caricature of yourself, particularly a caricature of yours and Simon's relationship and being paralleled with David's
and Michael's
relationship. How was that?
Yeah, it's odd because it's, you know, I do voiceovers as well, and every now and again, no, and quite a lot of people will say, you know, we just wanted the character to kind of just be you, you know, just like you're chatting with yeah. your mates down the pub. Yeah. And then you're like, well, fuck, what is that? What me is that? You know, yeah. I'm not sure.
You don't actually know me. So what do you think is me?
No, yeah, exactly. This is me, you know. Yeah, I haven't seen it, so I'd really like to see it, but it's... It was really, especially during lockdown too. I've been so lucky to be able to work and stuff.
Yeah.
And to do something with Michael and David. They're so bloody lovely. Yeah, but it was nice to definitely, you know, be a version of myself.
I love it. So what is ahead? I know you've been writing and you've got a script that's hopefully doing stuff. So what's the plan going forward at the moment?
You know, I've got a script in at Netflix, so they're looking at that, and there's bits and pieces of, you know, licensing agreements to be fucking signed and stuff like that, mm-hmm. business bullshit. And then I wrote a kid's book a few years ago, and I've got that published, so I'm just editing it at the moment. But, you know, I paint a lot. I'm painting, so I've got a nice studio that I sit in and I paint, and, you know, I think part of me trying to be a happier man means me also... being confident enough to say no, and that sometimes it's just fucking enough to sit and paint or to fucking not, or to just be online or to watch a fucking film, or, you know, it's
yeah,
that it's enough, that's fine too, you know. But that, I mean, that said, it's, we film the Nevers. I've got like 6 episodes of that to shoot, and I start filming the end of August, beginning of September.
Yeah,
but also, you know, we got a baby in 6 weeks, so
yeah,
it's going to be a bunch of baby business. So it's going to be that, and then running out and doing days here and there. And
do you think that's going to increase or decrease the amount of painting you do? Because I can imagine you sat with a baby in one arm and a paintbrush in the other on those times where there's no option of going to sleep or or doing anything other than being awake.
I don't know if that, because that my studio just fucking stinks like mess and white spirit.
That's a great point. So that's not sure a good place for a newborn, is it?
Well, my partner's in there constantly saying, oh, I fucking love it, I love the smell. Because I think she's after that smell, you know, her body craves that smell. But I don't know if maybe I'll like use it as a paintbrush and like paint with its head. And that would be like a thing for me.
This is my new art.
And then it says like painted using child's head.
Yeah.
As brush.
Yeah. Created by the Frosts.
Yeah, right.
It's a collaboration thing. Have you, this only came to mind as I was thinking of times we've interacted. Have you heard the talk of Attack the Block 2?
Yeah, I have. I spoke to Naira
That was the first premiere I ever went to I think, because you invited me along, and I'd never done any of that fucking premiere lark. I remember I was sitting behind Jonathan Ross, and just all sorts of proper famous people were there, and I was like, oh, shit. So, yeah, that film holds a warm place in my heart for many reasons. But, yeah, how's the word on Attack the Block 2?
Well, there's apparently a script being written, and I think it's being greenlit. So we had a conversation with Naira, the producer and stuff, and she was saying, well, Joe wants to know what you think, where you think the character would be and what's happened to him. And so there's that. But, I mean, I can't wait. I love being Ron. He was great.
Yeah, that'd be amazing. Well, thank you very much for giving me your time, sir. It's been bloody lovely to catch up with you.
Listen, man, it's always a pleasure. Yeah, I mean, I feel this version of the podcast, it's a bit more serious. But I think that's all right. I think it's difficult to be a fucking funny idiot all the time.
It's got to be, as you said, all of these things are about balance. And weirdly, I think since the first time we spoke, it is when the kind of the comfortableness of talking about mental health, of talking about all these other things has come in, and we don't have to give this false representation of who we are and how we are and everything else. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, all right. Well, next time we do it, hopefully we'll dive even deeper and we'll take our shirts off.
Yeah, I look forward to it. And I look forward to catching up in person as well, man. I miss the times when we'd go and grab some food or something with James or Nat or Simon or whomever's about. So, yeah, I look forward to the world allowing all of that
as well. I'm back now, and I'm kind of coming in and out of town, so let's definitely do that.
Let's do it. Well, lovely. Thanks, thank you very much, man. I'll talk to you soon.
You've been listening to Scroobius Pip's Distraction Pieces.
There we go. That was Nick Frost. I told you it was a goodie. And yeah, I loved having a good catch up with the lad. As I said, if this has been your first time tuning in, an easy episode to go back and check out would be the first chat that me and Nick had. But in general, if you put in your search engine, if you put Distraction Pieces podcast or Distraction Pieces, and then whoever might catch your eye, chances are I've had them on, and chances are you'll want to go and have a listen. So, yeah, there we go. I'll be back next week with more goodness, as always. Until then, stay sane and stay safe. Ta-ta.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.